Well, thank you very much indeed. And you could, I think, say that my job description is communicating the uncertainty in risk estimates to decision makers. And boy, is that challenging. So risk really is at the centre of scientists who advise government. And several of my colleagues are here and will be able to speak for it from their perspective. And I want to touch on three of the challenges. So the first is the challenge of the terminology involved, the distinction between risk and hazard. And that's a huge problem because people confuse the two. The challenge of uncertainty and actually our inability to put numbers on uncertainty. And I'm not going to give you a very numerical presentation, but I think one of the questions is, can we learn in government about management of risk from, for example, the insurance or reinsurance industry, which has to start putting numbers on some of this because that's how they sort out their premiums and hopefully don't run out of money. The second issue is the complicated issue of when you're advising policymakers and indeed talking with the public, recognising the different values and lenses that people use to look at issues. And I'll give you some concrete examples. And the third and last of the challenges is undoubtedly the challenge of clear communications. And it really is at the heart of what the Government Office for Science does. So I've talked before about one of the challenges that John Beddington faced, which is in the context of natural disasters, working out what are the risks to aeroplanes flying through clouds of volcanic ash. An issue that's quite at the forefront in both the American government and the UK government at the moment are the risks associated with space weather. Could we have another 1859 Carrington event? What would be the consequences of that on telecommunications, on electric grids, on satellites? Because the world now is very different to the world of more than 150 years ago. And of course, the extremely topical natural disaster of the flooding that's going on at the moment, and all of the questions about building in floodplains and the consequences of doing that, and how much do you spend to make housing safer to live in a floodplain. And then those are the hazards. The threats are human threats, of course, the threats of terrorism, the threat of human emissions of carbon dioxide and other pollutants in the atmosphere, the discharge of pollutants from ships and from other sources. And I would say on a day-to-day basis, risk comes into the work of Go Science. Now, we have a national risk register. It's freely available, and in fact, there is also a national risk assessment, which contains some classified material as well. And this is a fairly sort of classic view of looking at risk registers, which is to have on the ordinate the potential impact of the risk occurring, and on the abscissa, the likelihood. And you can see that right up at the top right-hand side, in other words, having the most impact and the most likelihood, we see pandemic human infection, and I think most of us would agree with that. And interestingly, severe space weather is there, though one can debate the impact of that. And then you can see all of the other things there. And in fact, I should say that this is actually putting together two slides from the 2012 edition of the National Risk Register, which then they conflate the threats, the human threats, and the natural hazards. Now, I think one of the big challenges, and where I think the scientific community can help, is the classic problem that we all have risk registers or should have risk registers in our organisations, but what do we then do with them? Are they very thick documents that sit on shelves, or do we use them in the way that risk registers ought to be used? And I think the challenge for a risk register is to use it to make decisions about how you can prevent things happening, so the Thames flood barrier being an obvious example of that, how you can mitigate, so reduce the impact of them, and putting up sandbags is an obvious example of how you're trying to stop something happening, reduce the impact, how you can manage it, and it's timely that I show you a picture with pumps on it, and then how you clear up afterwards. And my sense is that in both the private and the public sector, we don't use our risk register sufficiently to actually prevent, to mitigate, to manage and to clear up. And one of the big questions is, should one be able to use a risk register to actually decide the relative investment that one puts into those different ovals there? Is it a basis for thinking about how you invest? Because you have to make choices, particularly with public money. There's a lot of confusion about these concepts, and this is a particular confusion in regulation. So the risk here is obvious, and that is that the crocodile will snap its jaw shut on the plover. The hazard is the teeth of the crocodile in this case, and in fact our houses are full of hazardous substances. Risk is actually the product of hazard and our exposure related to our vulnerability. Our uncertainty might be looking at this. We are uncertain as to whether this plover is at risk or not. The plover itself is pretty comfortable because actually it turns out not to be vulnerable to the crocodile. But if we happen to put our arm in, we would definitely be vulnerable. And I think there's a lot of confusion between these terms, and particularly between risk and hazard. And I think the issue of pesticides illustrates this extremely clearly. And the challenge is pesticides, pests, and pollinating insects. And Europe has recently created a moratorium over the use of pesticides, neonicotinoid pesticides, in agriculture. And in fact, the UK opposed this moratorium. And the issue here is not whether neonicotinoid pesticides are hazardous to insects. They're extremely hazardous to insects. They were designed to be hazardous to insects, hence the term insecticides. The challenge in their use is to kill the insects you don't want whilst limiting the damage to the insects you do want. And therefore, the real question is, under field conditions, is the exposure of other pollinating insects unacceptable? Because if the exposure to those other insects is at a safe level, then in fact you'll achieve the aim of the insecticide, which is to kill the insect you don't want versus the insect you do. And the problem here, to be frank, is that we don't really have absolutely robust evidence to enable us to answer this question. So it is perfectly clear that there are many laboratory conditions in which it's possible to demonstrate neonicotinoid insecticides have deleterious effects on bumblebees, honeybees, and other insects. There's no doubt about that at all. But what we don't have is clear evidence from the field as to whether, when these are applied according to the manufacturer's guidance, they cause toxic effects. And this, I think, is the challenge for regulation a lot of the time. The distinction between hazard, and we know a lot of things are hazardous, and risk. And there is a tendency to regulate by hazard rather than by risk. And this immediately takes us into the areas of new technologies. And I think that the challenge, and the communication here is extremely important, is that we have to recognize that there are risks associated with almost everything we do. But we have to manage risk and not duck it. And I think there's a tendency to duck risk all the time. And so in the case of GMOs, and we've had plenty of sessions here on genetically modified organisms over the years, the mistake we make when we talk about them is that we talk about them in a generic sense. But there's nothing generic about a genetically modified organism. The question is, what organism, what genetic modification, for what purpose? And then we can start having sensible discussions about hazard and risk, rather than trying to treat a whole technology as though it poses a single collection of risks. And we have the precautionary principle. And the problem is, the precautionary principle, I think, is increasingly interpreted to say, if there's any possibility of anything harmful at all, let's not do it. You can't argue against the precautionary principle. It actually makes perfect sense. And John Perkins, my colleague in BIS, and the UK in general interpret the EU communication on the precautionary principle as follows. It's based on the fullest possible scientific evaluation of the hazards associated with something. And then a decision to act or not is basically preceded by a risk evaluation of not only the hazards, but also the consequences of not doing something, the consequences of inaction. It is about being transparent, and it basically takes into account the general principle of risk management, in other words, being proportionate, doing a risk-benefit analysis, doing a cost-benefit analysis, and constantly keeping it under review as new evidence emerges. But I think one of the problems is that we have asymmetric incentives to regulators. And what I mean by that is that a regulator will get into trouble if he or she allows something to happen that causes harm. However, a regulator will get into no trouble at all if they stop something happening that would have done good. And that is actually a profound problem, because it means the incentive system is loaded entirely in one direction. And we need to, I think, to recognise much more that harm can frequently flow from not doing something as well as from doing something. So to end briefly, and I hope what I'm doing in this presentation is framing the subsequent presentations, which I hope will be a bit more numerical than this one. I think sometimes we also are having two conversations about risks and hazards without realising it. So fracking, I think, is quite a good example of that, where on the one hand we have legitimate scientific and engineering questions about hydraulic fracturing in terms of, is there going to be damage to aquifer zones by leakage of contaminated fluids? Are there going to be significant seismic events? Is there going to be fugitive methane release? These are the key questions. And in the building just down the road from here, the Royal Society, working with the Royal Academy of Engineering, did an extremely good report on hydraulic fracturing and basically said that, well done, all of these concerns can be managed. But actually, if you then go and talk to the protesters in Sussex, there's actually a different conversation going on. It's not really a conversation about that. It's a different conversation. It's about a conversation with people who may be totally opposed to the oil and gas industry, who simply don't like capitalism sometimes, and a very strong knot in my backyard. And so one has two different conversations without actually realising it. And if we are going to communicate effectively and actually realise the impacts of the decisions that we're debating, then we do have to look through different lenses. And the insect lens shows the complication. I think issues that had as many lenses as the insect lenses would be quite impossible. But let's take the work now of Nick Pidgeon, who I think is in the audience, and his work on public values around energy and climate change. And so this is very nice work that he conducted in Cardiff. And in fact, I was in Bristol last night talking about climate change. And actually, the council does surveys there, and they get very similar answers. If you ask the population, about three quarters are very or fairly concerned about climate change and believe the UK should reduce its use of fossil fuels. A similar proportion are concerned that electricity and gas will become unaffordable for them. And a very similar proportion again, so all between 70 and 80%, are concerned about energy security, about us being dependent too much on energy from other sources. And these are the three policy lenses, which are, of course, important when talking about energy. And this is the sort of work that actually starts to unpick this, and exploring people's values around, on the one hand, reducing the use of finite resources, so people's feelings about avoiding waste, about being efficient, issues about social justice and fairness, environmental protection, that things should improve, and then reducing the overall levels of energy use on the right, so the availability and affordability, reliability, safety, and autonomy and freedom and choice and concern. And when we're debating these risk matters, then if we don't understand this, I think that we're in some difficulty. So this, I think, is my last slide, and it just illustrates, I think, some of the challenges that there are in risk communication. And BSE, of course, is extremely difficult because actually there's just an enormous amount of uncertainty that was associated with BSE at the time it emerged. Thinking back of the sort of various crises that a government chief scientist must have had to face, then I think BSE must have been extraordinarily difficult. The potential for very high impact, knowing very, very little about transmission, long-term consequences. So a great deal of uncertainty there. The issue of pesticides I've already discussed, and the important distinction between hazard and risk, and then some of the challenges, and I think this is a graph I've shown here before, this is from the IPCC report, around how we communicate climate change and how we actually manage risk, not for our generation, but for our grandchildren and their grandchildren's generation. In other words, how we take a long-term view of risk rather than a short-term view of risk. So there's a temporal element in all of this as well. And because this is a very pervasive subject, I'm cribbing an idea of Sally Davis, which is that she's produced for a number of years now an annual report on a particular topic, and recently, of course, it was on the rise of antibiotic resistance. And I intend to do the same, and the sort of possible title is Innovation Managing Not Ducking Risk, and I hope I might get help from a number of you in the audience. So thank you for your attention.